The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis. This is Music Weekly. This week, we hear from writer Peter Doggett. His new book, The Man Who Sold the World, does for Bowie's 1970s career what Ian MacDonald did for the Beatles. Plus, the team take on this week's MOBO Awards and there's new music from DRC Music, Joe McAlinden and Aluna George. All to come in this week's Music Weekly. Hello, I hope you're all enormously well. Welcome to this week's team. Kieran Yates, hello.
Hello.
You all right?
Yes, I'm fine. I'm a bit hungover.
Hanging on in there. You were at the MOBOs last night.
I was.
Which we're going to hear more about. You still got your wristband on. Is that
a
VIP wristband?
Such a tramp.
I wasn't for a minute implying that.
I've done the walk of shame in the Guardian offices.
Rob Fitzpatrick.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
I'm pleased to hear it. What have you been doing, eh?
Hey.
Sorry, it's a slightly aggressive manner.
Nothing I want to talk about.
Oh, okay,
fair enough. Listen, a few bits.
Okay, we will start with some new tracks. One from each of us, Singles Club. Let's begin with Rob's Choice. That's Joe McAlinden and Brown Bird Singing. Tell us a bit about Joe McAlinden.
Joe McAlinden used to be in a band called Superstar,
mm-hmm.
as you know, who were signed to Creation in the sort of pre-Oasis, slightly post-teenage fan club.
Yeah.
You could call them the glory years, sort of early 90s, very early 90s. And Superstar were fantastic, and they had their first release was called the Greatest Hits EP. Which gives you an idea of their sense of scale, and it was they were sort of doing that big super pop Wings ELO thing before anybody else had sort of rethought about doing that kind of thing, sort of years ahead of their time, and then also years behind the time as well, which is interesting. But Joe McAlinden is a fantastic songwriter. He's got a new record coming out, which is coming out on Edwin Collins' new label,
indeed,
and. It's just beautiful. It's just a beautiful piece of pop music.
Indeed. You know, Joe McAlinden also was in The Boy Hairdressers.
Yes,
indeed. The band that evolved into Teenage Fan Club. And I believe he's also associated with the BMX Bandits, as
I think
was legally required, I believe, in Glasgow.
Yeah.
The BMX Bandits. Yeah. He's now a restaurateur, I believe, somewhere.
Do you know? I didn't know.
I follow him on Twitter.
Yes, me too. I didn't know he was a restaurateur.
I believe, I might be wrong, I get the impression from his tweets that he's a restaurateur somewhere in the wilds of Scotland.
I think Ayr.
There you go.
I might be imagining that. Sorry, Joe, if I am.
I'm sorry if you're not a restaurateur. Yeah. I'm sorry if you're, you know.
Could be a dream. Although he did say to me the other day something about oysters. I said something about oysters, and he went, oh, you could come and have oysters. The fresh oysters from Loch Fyne.
From Loch Fyne. I saw that tweet, yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw this over to Kieran, who has been sitting there listening to us talking.
Got no idea what
we're absolutely, literally, we might have been, might as well have been speaking
head on the table.
Swahili,
Who are these old men?
Memories of a beautiful evening with JLS have just been ruined.
Ruined.
Kieran, did you like that record?
Yeah, I thought it was okay. It's quite weird when you hear something from a completely different genre when you're so used to writing about urban music. So it's quite nice to have a little bit of a change. And I quite liked it. It's quite... you know, makes you want to sway and rock, and you know, it's quite.
That might just be your hangover, darling.
I don't know. Yeah, it could be the Lucozade talking.
God bless them.
Yeah, I quite liked it. It sort of reminded me a little bit of the late REM a little bit.
Yes, I can see the link that you're making there. I mean, it has to be said, Joe is not. Redefining his musical boundaries.
No,
with
he's
record.
Not.
I mean, it still sounds a bit like. He's a man who heard Big Star.
He knows what he likes, and he likes and what he bloody well knows.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's really good. I think it's really well put together piece of music. Really interesting that Edwin Collins is starting a record label in the company of
James Endicott.
Yeah. Formerly the man who signed the Libertines, of course, and the Strokes to Rough Trade, and was formerly the guitarist in Loop.
Yeah, indeed.
Bass player in Loop.
He was in Loop.
He's definitely in Loop, yeah. In the cover of Heaven's End.
Yeah.
Once again, I can just see you.
I'm still here, guys. Yeah.
But look, that's a double A-side, limited edition, 7-inch single coming out to celebrate the launch of Edwin Collins' new label. It's got two tracks on it from the forthcoming album, Bleached Highlight. Good name. Good name for an album.
Bleached Guess what Highlight. The B-side sounds like?
Does it sound a bit like Big Star?
It does.
Excellent. Yes. Excellent.
It's very good.
No, it's consummate pop songwriting in that vein. Yeah. Thumbs up for Joe. It's released on the 24th of October on AED Records. The next track is my choice. That's a bit of Departure by DRC Music there. DRC Music is the latest instalment in the ongoing, and I find quite increasingly fascinating, career of Damon Albarn. This time he's taken a load of different producers. I think it's fair to say producers rather than musicians, people like Richard Russell from XL Records, Totally Enormous Extinct Dinosaurs, and many others. Actress, I think, he went out there with him, to the Congo, and made a record with a variety of different Congolese musicians. What I really, really like about this is there's a lot of tracks up on their SoundCloud page, and none of them are, you know, like traditional Congolese music with a breakbeat underneath it. They're all really strange. This particular track, Departure, that's a bit of it. It goes into something that completely sounds totally different and sort of shoegazy and sort of mad, and then goes into a mental bit of rapping in some crazy African dialect that I've absolutely no idea. And I just thought, wow, this is really taking source material that you can use, that tends to get used in a certain way. You know, African music tends to get sampled in a certain way, and making really weird, forward-thinking, kind of left-field, exciting music out of it. But having begun Damon Albarn's career fairly steadfast in the belief the guy was a Burke, he seems to have revealed himself to be like the solitary polymath genius that Britpop produced.
Yeah.
One hesitates to compare him to David Bowie, but in the sense of reinvention, anyway, I'm going on. DRC Music.
You like the guy, right?
I like him, yeah. Having said a load of stupid things about him being a div in the press, I'm sort of trying to make up for that fact. The album's coming out on Warp, which sort of makes sense, I think, if you hear that. Rob.
I thought, you know, decent edit, you got a top 40 smash on your head. I mean, it's just one chorus after another, isn't it?
It's totally not, is it? I mean, there's no pop sensibility about it whatsoever.
It's not a Mickey Most production. No. I like that kind of thing. I like something. It reminded me a little of an album. To not talk about that for a second, an album by a guy called Nils Fram. I think it's Nils Fram.
Okay.
In the sense that you've got this sort of improvised sort of feel to it, and this other guy's just sort of twingling his piano strings like that. What I really like about that is it's not trying to sell you anything. It's not trying to. It's there for you to kind of discover it, rather than it's banging, like you say, you know, getting something with a breakbeat on it or someone doing this.
It's not trying to discover. What it's not trying to do is go, hey people, don't be scared of African music.
It doesn't have any African music tropes to it either.
It does at the end. When you get to like 8 minutes, it's very clearly something from
Africa. Quickly
chuck them in. Kieran.
I really liked it. I quite liked the really slow atmospheric build-up, which is, you know, what I like about things like post-dubstep. And it reminded me, I did a feature early in the year where I went to Morocco to discover the urban music scene there.
Wow.
And it reminded me a little bit of Gnawa, which is one of the kind of the musical traditions from an African music tradition, which comes from sub-Saharan Africa, which, you know, slaves brought over. And it's this kind of thing. It's, you know, quite atmospheric, you know, very sort of simple. And it sounds quite similar, actually, if you listen to
I've never heard of this kind of music.
Yeah, Gnawa. So it's Gnawa.
What was the urban scene like in Morocco when you went over there, Kieran?
It was kind of quite split into two camps. So on one hand, there were artists like Don Big, who is...
Great name.
Don Big, who is a massive guy, a massive figure. He's very, very popular.
What's his music like?
It's just like rapping. Controversial rapping, you know, political slant, but a subtle one. Female MCs that we spoke to out there. And yeah, it was great. I think that in Marrakesh, there's a real contrast between traditionalism and modernism, and it was really interesting to see that firsthand.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely
especially female MCs in Morocco.
Yeah, that's pretty hardcore,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah,
it's pretty ballsy. Watch out. Amazing. Well, look, DRC Music, their album is out on Warp on the 23rd of October. Very diverse. There's loads of tracks up on the SoundCloud page. Go and check it out. They're all very, very different from each other, and that track isn't in any way representative of what the rest of it sounds like. Our last track? It's Kieran's choice. If you want to train me like an animal, better keep your eye on my every move. There's no need to be so damn cruel. Maybe you've got nothing to prove. I'm no fool, no, I'm not a follower. I don't take things as they come. Aluna George there, and you know you like it. And I do like it.
I do.
Said in a Radio 2-ish kind of way. I think that's wicked.
I know, I think I saw you dancing there, Alexis.
Not so much dancing, is it?
I was just having a fit.
Dad's dance, though.
time for my injection, that's what the problem is. Kieran, you brought this in. I know nothing about Aluna George. I know nothing about this track. Tell me all about it, please.
Okay, they are a unsigned duo, Aluna and George. Aluna are on vocals, George on production. From London, and they released this from Rafferty's label called Super Recordings, and Rafferty's signed to, as you know, Ninja Tune.
Right.
So it's quite nice how there's that kind of musical connection between all of them.
So this is out. I mean, this is available.
Oh yeah,
to purchase
this is out. It's out. You can see it on YouTube. It's got thousands of views, and yeah, then they've got a remix album coming out later in the year, and then a follow up, I think, early next year. So that'll be quite good. And yeah, I really love it. I think that the track itself is, you know, kind of sexy, makes you want to dance. It's really great. It would have a great dubstep remix of it, I think. Mm-hmm. But really, I think it says a lot about the female UK scene at the moment, especially as we know, you know, Jessie J cleaned up at the Mobos yesterday. She won 4 awards. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's quite an interesting angle to really look at what, you know, women are doing at the moment. Mm. And, you know, Aluna on the vocals in the video, it's very polished. She looks lovely. She sounds quite distinctive. And there's, you know, there's lots of great things happening. I think in grime, there's, you know, I think you've spoken a lot about Roxanne and Lady Leisha and Nole, people like that on, you know, in grime doing quite interesting emceeing. But I think also on the flip side of that, you know, people that sound a little bit more pop or a little bit more soul infused, like Aluna George and last year Andrea Triana, and you know, she's signed from Ninja Tune, who are great. They kind of release consistently good stuff, and she toured with Bonobo on the vocals, and she did lots of good stuff with them. And people like Fabiana Palladino, she's got an EP coming out.
This is the equivalent to me of the conversation that
how
that,
do
that
you guys not know this
obscure 80s indie, isn't it? I love this. I really love this. I'll tell you why I like it.
Okay.
I take the point that you're making about Jessie J. I would say the big difference between this record and Jessie J's sound is that this record doesn't make me want to kill everybody involved in the manufacture and production of the in the way that Jessie J does.
Yeah.
What I like about it is an R&B track, and it's got a bit of edge to it. It's got a bit of sonic experimental edge back to it, which R&B has lost. Yeah. I went to see Rihanna last night, and it was great.
Oh, she was on the Jubilee line,
apparently. So I totally missed her.
Brilliant.
She was also on top of a tank in her pants on stage.
Well done that, Alexis.
Well, you know,
getting
a few drinks.
Spanked, you
and she was, there was all that kind of malarkey going on, and you know.
Spanked on a tank.
But what struck me was that her music, there is an original strand to her music, but a lot of her music has sort of descended into that generic fall to the floor, house beats, rave synthesizers that just sounds like everything else. And I sort of thought, wow,
Guetta, right?
Guetta. Yeah. Who would have predicted from R&B 10 years ago that it would end up sounding like kind of slightly naff 90s house? It's stupid. You know? And, you know, I hanker for the glory days of sort of Timbaland and, you know, Dark Child, where they're making really forward-thinking music. And this strikes me, well, it doesn't sound literally like that, to have that kind of a head on it, and therefore, thumbs up for Aluna George for me, Rob.
Absolutely, I'd never heard of Aluna or George.
No,
I liked it very, very much. I agree with everything that everyone said in a rather boring way. You could see the sort of Soul to Soul and the Syndicate and the Unique Three and the sort of Massive Attack and lots of those kind of flavours in there as well. There's nice dub. There was quite bouncy. It was a bit funkadelic. There was all this kind of this huge mass of music kind of behind it. It was on the shoulders of all this great music. And I thought it was great. I thought she's got a fantastic voice, great production. I liked the fact that it was very non-linear. You know, you didn't know where it was going next. It wasn't following a chorus and a verse pattern, and there's the bridge and all that. And I like all that stuff, but it was surprising, which I think is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Listen to it, you don't know what it's going to do next, and that's really good. That's really refreshing. I thought it was great. Two thumbs up from me.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I think because there's so much been written about people like Jessie J and Rihanna, I think you get surprised when you realise that actually there's a lot of really interesting things happening with kind of female artists.
That's out in August, but the album will be released in November.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, look, we'd like your reviews from this week's selection of tracks. We've noticed the comments have dropped off a bit recently. What are you doing, people? Come on. Wake up, sheeple. Wake up. So come on, listeners, sort it out. Leave your thoughts on the blog at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly or tweet us at musicweeklypod, all one word. Next on the programme, John Dennis has been chatting to author Peter Doggett. Peter's put together a book on 70s-era David Bowie. He's analytically gone through every track in that period to work out what was going on in his world and what influenced classic albums like Low, Diamond Dogs, Hunky Dory, you know the ones I'm talking about. John began mentioning that Peter's last book about the Beatles, which I believe was called You Never Give Me Your Money and was an exploration of the financial ruin of Apple Records, was an interesting lead into this one, as it suddenly made clear the extent of the influence of the band on David Bowie.
I'm not sure I'd realised, actually, until I actually sat down and started listening to the songs one by one in the order they came out. I mean, when you think about it, it's pretty obvious because the influence of the Beatles in the 60s was so enormous that it was almost impossible to escape it. And then I seem to remember there was a point in the mid-70s when suddenly it was the most embarrassing thing in rock to admit that you'd ever heard the Beatles. But like the rest of his generation, Bowie was bound to be influenced. But that influence survived beyond the early 70s when he's writing very sort of Paul McCartney-inflected pop songs and using a kind of John Lennon-type voice right the way through to the end of a decade. I mean, he was obviously a huge fan of the John Lennon Plastic Ono Band album. And you could trace the influence of that record all the way through the 70s, I think, on Bowie.
And similar to the way the Beatles changed radically and astonishingly from record to record, you know, with a huge sort of volume of output, Bowie did this in the 70s. And what I found, another thing I found fascinating reading the book was that these multiple voices you can sometimes hear within one song.
Mm. If you go back to the mid-60s things, you occasionally get a preview of the station-to-station voice, the way that he croons Wild as the Wind. You can hear that on some of his 60s things. For my love is like the wind,
and wild is the wind. Now, I should say that this project, song-by-song look at David Bowie's work in the 70s was inherited, actually, wasn't it, from the late Ian MacDonald, who'd done famously kind of done a job similar to this on the Beatles' work with Revolution in the Head.
That's right. At the time of his death, he was under contract to the same editor that I work with to write a book about Bowie in the 70s. And what happened was it came up in a discussion, and we all sort of wondered, how far did he get? Was there a book? And So the editor said, well, would you be interested if there was something that was 95% done in, you know, having a look at it and seeing what it needed? And I said, sure. And I went away and started to get excited about it. And I sat down for a day and played the entire 70s catalogue right through in chronological order, at the end of which I was going, yeah, this is great. I'm really looking forward to this project. And then they came back and said, well, sorry, we can't find any manuscript at all. We don't think he even started. By which point I said, well, this is mine. This is my project. I want it. Give it to me. Take a look at the old man, beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if he'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Mars? With a project like this, you're doing it in chronological order.
Yeah, I mean, that was slightly difficult to unpick, isn't it? Because we're not quite sure in some instances which order songs were recorded.
Indeed, in the second half of the 70s, as far as I know, none of the experts on Bowie have got any idea which order the songs were recorded for on the album. So you have to go by internal evidence, which is the first song where he starts to use a certain writing technique. Or in the case of Oh, You Pretty Thing, that was the second song that he actually wrote on the piano. And you can hear his instincts, all his creative instincts awakening when he discovers that he can't really play the piano, but if he sits down with three fingers in the right hand and one finger in the left hand and makes simple chords and then goes down the keyboard, you get this wonderful sound. And out of that really simple, quite simple trick, you get Oh, You Pretty Thing, you get Life on Mars. What he was very good at in the 70s was finding ways to unlock his creativity. If he felt himself getting blocked, he wouldn't do what every other rock star did, which is just to fake it, just to keep repeating himself. He would always go, no, I need something else, I need some new stimulus. Now, whether that was something illegal, or whether it was something like the occult, or reading a different kind of poetry, or chopping his lyrics up and throwing them in the air, whatever it was, for the entire decade, he was able to renew his creativity.
And this kind of devotion to changing, and you know, rather than consolidating successes, but shedding the various skins that he'd adopted for his last record, a lot of it seemed to be a flight from the insanity that he'd been told as a young boy that was his kind of inheritance. You know, it was some sort of genetic problem in his family.
Around him, there's always turmoil. There's half brothers, half sisters. Half-sisters who've been given up for adoption and just vanish. And then on his mother's side, there's his half-brother for a start who gradually declines into a form of schizophrenia in the late 60s. And back before that, there have been various aunts and so on who've also struggled with mental problems and ended up in psychiatric hospitals. And the story has it that at a very formative age, David was told by his mother, everybody on our side of the family goes mad in the end, which is one of those things that parents say to children sometimes and probably don't mean. But I think it, especially as he watched his brother, who he is very close to, starting to decline, I think that had a huge impact on him. And I think the way he reacted to that was to keep busy and to keep moving, both artistically and physically as well.
After Scary Monsters, he had a huge success, obviously, with Let's Dance in 83. But even by that time, there was less artistically interesting about that. And he just seemed to kind of, him and the zeitgeist seemed to go in separate directions.
I think to answer that, I'd have to take you back to the late 70s, to Berlin, where he, at that point, 77, he's really pushed himself out on the edge in physical terms and in artistic terms. I mean, he's completely thrown away everything that anybody knew about David Bowie and has come up with this entirely new way of making records with Brian Eno. And I think at that point, he finally got himself into a position where he had exhausted that initial creative drive. And I think Scary Monsters is an album about, this isn't working for me anymore. How am I going to deal with this? And then he starts doing film acting as well, which is a way of him distancing himself. He can play other roles. The old lifestyle, that old sort of turbulent creativity, didn't work for him. But he's a pro, and he's very good at marketing himself. So he came back with Let's Dance in 1983, which, again, is not to my taste. It's not my favourite Bowie album by any means. It's a fantastically polished, slick pop album, one of the great 80s records in that sense. Song they're playing. But to me, it was a real step back from the edge. And I think he was scared to get back in touch with his deepest feelings and deepest urgings because he knew how much it had cost him in the 70s. And the irony is that he then becomes a nostalgia act like every other rock band of his age. Except that in 94, 95, suddenly he goes back in again and he finds a new way, as Bob Dylan had done in the 70s, of reaching inside himself without killing himself at the same time. And he makes a series of really interesting albums, The Buddha of Suburbia and Outside, I think, being the best two.
But over the last decade, we've not heard very little from him at all. What's happened to him now? What's he doing now?
Well, he was on tour in 2004, 2005, that sort of period, and he had very bad health and he had to have a emergency heart operation. And since then, he hasn't made any new record, he hasn't made any new albums. Perhaps finally he's found peace and he's found a way to live with himself that doesn't involve flogging himself in public.
Peter Doggett there with John Dennis. Rob.
Yes.
You've read this book.
I have.
I've read it as well.
Hey.
Done my research.
Let's make secret notes later. Yeah.
What did you make of it?
I thought it was a fantastic book, actually.
Did you?
I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it because I think one of the things that I particularly enjoyed about it, and if people don't know, it's the format is a kind of revolution in the head. So every song is sort of covered in detail with sort of essays around it. Or every song is in the 70s. And it's just, first and foremostly, it just really makes you want to re-engage with the music.
It's which a great thing.
Is the most important thing for anything. And it's just, it's sort of full of information that you sort of, it's full of new ideas. Because it's not just like, well, here's another plod through the David Bowie's life story, which has been done endlessly. And it was, you know, until he talks to someone about it, there's really not anything new to say about it. But it goes back to the work and it goes back to these amazing songs and I loved it. I thought it was great, a fantastic.
I agree with you to a degree. I felt I couldn't help but feeling it. Once you read the introduction, and Peter Doggett is very frank in the introduction that at the time of his suicide, Ian MacDonald was working on this book effectively, and he was going to write a second Revolution, the follow-up to Revolution in the Head, which is, if you don't know, I mean, I'm sure you all do, but if you don't know, is probably the best book about the Beatles ever written. I mean, it's just a sort of forensic examination of every Beatles song ever recorded, but fantastically entertaining, brilliant, brilliant piece of writing. The follow-up was going to be a book about Bowie's 70s material, and he sort of picked up the reins. And you know, it's very honest of him to do that. But the minute I found that out, I started immediately mourning the loss of the Ian MacDonald book. Because, I mean, that would have been just an amazing thing. However, he has managed to dig up some new and original things, I think.
Does the book cover that rumour that for 1 year he lived on milk, peppers and cocaine?
It does.
It does.
Yes, it sort of does. And it's not so much a rumour. I think it's sort of
basically fact.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, he also, at the same time, used to keep his urine in bottles in the fridge in case anybody stole it and tried to perform magic spells against him.
But it was actually, there was also, he describes it in the book, he basically lived on Complan, those sort of diet drinks, or there was sort of protein drinks.
Really.
But you'd say we'd go for sort of day, kind of a day or so with nothing, and then we'd have just sips of something. And that would be it. I mean, we've all been. That's how I get by. You know, Bugle and Complan.
That's always amazing about that period of Bowie's life. Is that in the middle of all of this, in this just cocaine insanity, he makes Station to Station, which is arguably the best record he ever made.
Yeah.
A record that, you know, it says in the book, talking about Stage, an amazing track, you know, it's a really hard funk kind of brilliant record. And Carlos
Alomar,
who plays the guitar riff on it, just says, you know, we just did so many drums. I have literally no recollection of making this record at all. I can't remember a note of it.
Yeah.
And it's just this brilliant, it's not like some stupid drugged out.
No. Yeah.
It's this like, I think Dorian Lynskey said, the thing about Station to Station is, for all it's part of this, you know, this terrible narrative where Bowie nearly kills himself with drugs. It's actually sort of basically an album that's kind of the upside of cocaine.
It's like that thing,
you know, of like, I'm just, when you're really sharp, mentally sharp and on it and you know. Anyway.
Obviously, X Factor judges should be advising.
That's exactly what they should do. They should make Joey Carcosa. Oh, whatever he's called, Joey Carcosa, Charlie Carcosa, the one with the bum trap, the one keeps showing his ass. They should make him live off a diet of milk, peppers, and cocaine throughout the entirity of X Factor, and see if he makes station to station.
Generation.
You know? It would be amazing. There's all sorts of things you could. That's the twist. That's you know they say it.
Oh yeah,
they said, didn't they? On the end of last week.
There's going to be a twist.
They're
all going to move into separate mansions in LA, live with Glenn Hughes from Deep Purple, and they just have to survive on sort of vodka and coke and see what they come up with.
See what happens.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Peter Doggett's book about David Bowie.
Yes, of course.
We should press on. Actually, Peter Doggett's book about David Bowie. What was the most remarkable thing about it? Do you feel?
I think that there's a particularly interesting sort of strand which is about the sort of the seam of madness that runs through David Bowie's family and from his mother's side, I think, if I remember correctly, and his elder half brother Terry, who is a very this is done brilliantly in the book, and is. His huge influence on the sort of the young David, and would take him to Soho and take him around, you know, interesting shops and galleries and introduce him to books and art and ideas and things like that. And that there's a good theory that Peter follows through in the book, which is that Bowie's kind of enormous creativity came from wanting to during that era came from wanting to skirt the edges of this insanity that he felt he could sort of touch on like a fire, you know, and then whoa, and then back away from. And so he had this sort of two elements. This creativity was that this sort of personal sense of, if I work it this hard, I can use this sense of madness to my own advantage. But also his ideas of creating creating sort of movements and then destroying them immediately. So you create a movement, people would follow it, then you'd destroy it and build another one. Mm. And so you had these two things where which could provoke that sort of endless cycle of creativity.
No, amazing cycle of creativity. Yeah. Obviously, the bit about him just touching on madness, you know, I can just touch on it and get away from one like. Yeah. Because the problem with doing that is sooner or later you end up in a mansion in LA living off cocaine, you know,
with Glenn Hughes.
Milk and peppers with Glenn Hughes, and then you come to London and do an arty salute at Victoria Station,
yes,
which is,
indeed.
You know,
that is the downside.
He did
Alexis.
Sort of go a bit crackers.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, amazing body of work, David Bowie's 70s work. You know, it's
literally some great records, mate.
The book. The Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie, and the 1970s is out now. So, this week saw the Mobo Awards take place. Jessie J cleaned up at the ceremony. She won four of the categories. Adele, Rihanna, Tinchy Strider took home most of it. Did Tinchy Strider win? Did my boy Tinch win?
He did. Well, he had a joint win with Dappy for best video.
Anyway, look, the awards took place in Glasgow.
For some reason.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Weird place. Why did we find out why they're in Glasgow? Kieran, you're our woman on the spot.
Well, hang on, wait. I bought you a present.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah.
Shortbread fingers. Break them out. Wow. Come on, baby. This is brilliant. Thank you so much. Wow.
You're welcome. It was really, really well received. I mean, it's been in London. It was in Liverpool last year. I think he's going to skip a year and be back in Liverpool next year and then in Glasgow again.
Mm. I last went to the Mobos some years ago, and there was this definite sense... Yeah, they had it at the Royal Albert Hall. It was the year there was.
Oh, you went to that one. Yeah, that's
there was people protesting outside about homophobic reggae, and then people protesting about homophobic reggae, and there was also and there was some guy playing the bongos, and it was all going off outside. Yeah. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. Inside, the problem was that you just felt all these awards were going to Americans. None of them had bothered to because you know they don't really know where Britain is, and it just felt like a real kind of. You know, but through no fault of their own, it just felt like a bit of a sort of, I don't know how to say it, like a addendum. You know, like it was just something stuck on. It wasn't really working.
But it reflected the market at that time.
Yeah, is that what, this one was a bit more oomphy.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it's a difficult one, really, because it's great that so many of the UK artists have really been represented. But I think, really, I mean, on Twitter last night, there was kind of a a barrage of negativity towards it. And mm-hmm. I just think that, that's not necessarily from, you know, people thinking that people were robbed. I mean, obviously, Wretch 32 not coming mm-hmm. home with anything, you mm-hmm. know, was that was a shame, really. And
yeah.
I would have liked Wiley to win Best Video and things like that. But I think that it's more that the Mobos have a bit of an identity crisis at the moment. Mm-hmm. And they don't know whether to be, you know, whether they're championing really, really grassroots mm-hmm. Acts or whether they're doing that really big budget mainstream, you know, highly produced award ceremony. Mm-hmm. And I think that actually, I completely understand what Kanye King, who's the kind of the big don and founder of the Mobos, is trying to do with that and tried to kind of straddle both worlds. But I think that it would perhaps work better either be completely grassroots, mm-hmm. you know, and have a grime category, have a best, you know, DJ category, have a dubstep category, and, you know, completely represent, you know, the urban music scene in that way, or just, you know, be the Grammys, you know,
yes,
be
huge. And I think this is reflected in the number of things that Jessie J has won, because I find it very, very difficult to believe that the British urban music scene has not, on some level, produced a better album than Jessie J's record.
I didn't know she had an album.
She did, Jessie J?
Yeah.
Of course she has.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I thought she'd just done that.
Listening to Joe McAllister. But, I know, she did that one about money, right?
Yes! That was her. Right, I'm not including this discussion anymore. Now, because I just think that is stupid, giving the best album to Jessie J, because there's been, you know, I mean, surely Tiny Temper's album is better than Jessie J's. You know what I mean?
Wiley's album is better.
Yeah, there's loads of people. But, I mean, say you wanted to give a slightly more marquee name than Wiley. You know what I mean? A better name. Give it Tiny Temper. Don't keep giving noise to Jessie J.
Tiny Temper might have been released too long ago.
But, I mean, it is a public vote, so...
Is it? Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's all done.
Is it,
it's all done online.
That's the mistake.
That's the big mistake they're making. So how it works is there's a music panel, or, you know, kind of tastemakers that, you know, talk through categories, talk through things that should or shouldn't be there. And then people vote on the Mobos.com, which I think probably is a problem.
I mean, this is an age-old sort of Mobos problem, but if it's the Music of Black Origin Awards... You do. I mean, you know, I think it's a bit of a struggle to find that in Jessie J's music, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, to be honest with you, it's easier to find the Black Origin, the White Stripes music than it is Jessie J's music.
Yes.
I was thinking about this morning, thinking, what should they do with the Mobos? I would bite the bullet and call it the British Black Music Awards.
BBA.
BBA.
Yeah.
Good title.
I spoke to Kanye King yesterday about this, actually, and she was just saying, look, you know... They represent music as it is at the moment, and, you know, in terms of the whole race debate, she said, look... All, you know, most pop has its roots in black culture, black origins.
Absolutely. All pop music
has it. So I think that idea that it's been integrated so widely into kind of mainstream white audiences, you know, I think that. I don't think that it's an issue, really. And
I just think that it would be nice to see, particularly at a time when British urban music, really British urban music, is doing incredibly well in the charts in a way that you would never, ever have predicted in a million years. You know what I mean? Mm. 10 years ago, whatever. I think it would be really, really nice to see some of those people getting rewarded.
When it's got an identity and a voice that
of its own. I mean, it's never been stronger.
Well, it doesn't have a strong enough identity.
Why isn't there a dubstep award in it?
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about a music that's gone completely kind of global. And has gone and is, you know, influenced producers and artists all over, even like huge sort of pop artists and hip hop artists and stuff like that. And then it's not represented in there.
They have all these other categories: best reggae, best jazz act, best African act.
No, best dancehall either.
I suppose because of the issues they had in the past with the whole, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Bonfire upon the Chi Chi Man whole aspect of things.
Yes.
Alexis, you went there.
Yeah, he's laughing. Well, it's the truth. It's the absolute truth. I mean, I think it's good that Alba Rosie, Kairos Fortet, Wizkid, and Triple O are getting a bit of pops. Well, look, I think it's interesting. This conversation is interesting because it has I've always sort of thought, oh, is it the point of the Mobos is, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
This conversation has actually slightly changed my mind on that. And I do see what the point of the Mobos is.
Mm.
But I think we have decided between the three of us that it's not quite achieving the point that it's meant to be achieving. And I do feel sorry for that lady.
Kanye King.
Because every year she gets it in the neck.
She does.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can't please everyone.
No.
No, but then to be fair, every award show gets it in the neck every year. You know, right. Everyone. The Brits get it in the neck. Mercury's get it
Alexis
in the neck.
Alexis gets it in the Alexis neck. Alexis gets it in the neck. Right, I don't mind. You know.
Yeah. I don't mind, man. I'm hardened to all this.
I know. I mean, people like getting in the neck, to be fair, don't they?
Yeah.
These people are taking notice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, totally. Well, look, that's the Mobos for this year. Let's wrap things up for this week's programme. That's it for now. Thank you so much to Kieran Yates for
coming in.
Thank you. Always a pleasure. Rob Fitzpatrick.
Thank you very much for asking
less of a pleasure to see you, but never mind.
A little bit less. More of a chore.
Thank you too for listening. The programme is produced by Scott Cawley. I'm Alexis Petridis. We're back next Friday. See you then. Bye bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.